Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. You can subscribe to us on Stitcher, on Apple, on Google Play, any of the places that have a high quality or even a middling quality podcast. And we're joined here in our podcast studio by Peter Weiner. So first of all, I'll say, hey, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it very, very much.
I'm thrilled to be here. I'm great admirer of your work, so thanks for having me.
I want to read the biography here. It's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I think people know you write very widely on political, cultural, religious, national security issues. You've written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic. You served in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations before becoming deputy director of speechwriting for President George W. Bush. And in 2002, you were asked to head the Office of Strategic Initiatives. So when we talk about the White House, I'm doing all that because you've been in the White House. And so I want to talk about what's happening in the White House today. Before we do this, though, I want to thank you for introducing me to someone that I don't think otherwise I ever would have encountered. I get your newsletter on a regular basis, and I think it was probably about 2 years ago, you sent out something about Frederick Buechner. And I have to tell you that I'm willing to admit I was not familiar with his work. Subsequently, I went out and bought many of Frederick Buechner's books. For listeners who are not familiar, one of the most extraordinary theological writers of our time. I cannot believe that I didn't encounter him before.
Yes. Buechner is a beautiful writer. He's a Presbyterian minister. He's in his 90s now, early 90s, still alive, novelist, poet, writes on theology, and is a person who has both a deep faith and a real grasp, in my opinion, of the subtleties of faith and human life and the complexities. And I've read several of his books and really almost enchanted by his writing. And he's somebody that his faith pilgrimage is one that that I have a lot of sympathy with. I'm a person of the Christian faith, but it wasn't an easy faith for me. I had a lot of questions and doubts along the way, and as I say, I sort of viewed the fact that he had so much nuance in my estimation and subtlety about faith and didn't put it into these neat boxes appealed to me, and I felt like that I saw things reading him that I wouldn't have seen before, and I felt like he was an authentic and an honest voice.
You use the word enchanted, and he's one of those stylists that you read in if you're a writer, you're alternatively inspired in despair at not being able to write like him. But he's also a really significant religious voice about a kind of Christianity that sometimes seems to be in eclipse. Now, you mentioned your pilgrimage. I don't really know much about this. Are you a current convert, or are you just somebody who came back to where you started?
No, I was actually, when I grew up, I wasn't a person of the Christian faith. I didn't go to church when I was in my teens. At the end of high school, I actually began the journey of faith with my closest friend, a fellow named Brad Shannon. And I don't know what triggered it, but at the same time, we started to have these questions. And there was a summer, I think it was my junior year in high school, where I began to explore these questions. My sister is 5 years older
than I am. That's a dangerous age, isn't it?
It is. It is a dangerous age. In this case, it actually had some good benefits, but as a general matter, you can get into trouble at that time. But my sister came back. She was at the University of Washington, and she was back for the summer. And so I remember jotting down on my dad's work notepad all of these questions I had about faith, how does it make sense and so forth. And she ended up connecting me with a fellow named Carl Kopic, who is now a pastor in the city I grew up in, which is Richland, Washington. And he started a Bible study when I was still not a person of the Christian faith. That began the journey. Then I went to the University of Washington, and I met a fellow named Steve Hainer, who turned out to be one of the really key figures in my life. He was a youth pastor at University Presbyterian Church. My faith journey was initially very cognitive and intellectual, so I had to work through a lot of things. But then as time went on, I had my heart and my affections won over to Christ. But I'm still a person, and people who know me well would testify to this, pastors, theologians, friends, who engages in a lot of questions and try to make sense of things. The Bible, its veracity, how it fits in this time and this moment, what does it mean to be faithful? But that whole area of theology really does fascinate me, I think partly because to me it deals with the most important questions in the human journey, which is questions of meaning and purpose.
So the last few years, because you write about the intersection of culture, politics, and religion, the last few years, have they strengthened or tested your faith?
Yeah, it's a good question.
They're not mutually exclusive.
No, they're not. They're not mutually exclusive. I think my faith has deepened, actually, in an emotional sense, that my attachments and my affections to Jesus are deeper than they were. It doesn't have to do with things that are unfolding in the world. I think it has to do more with things that are unfolding in my own personal life and the people that are in my life. I'm one of those people, I must say, that as involved as I've been in politics, and I've been involved in my entire life, and I care very much about it, and I have strong feelings about it. But I just think politics is limited in its importance. And in my experience, it's the human relationships that make the difference. It's your family. It's the joy. It's the periods of suffering that you go through. Those are the things that really do shape us.
Well, let me ask you why I asked that question, because you're a long time conservative, if you want to call yourself an activist or, you know, writer, part of a conservative movement. Have you been experiencing a crisis of faith in that respect? Where you think, I thought I knew who I was. I thought I knew what my place was. I thought I knew what I believed. And all of that is up in the air now. All of that is being challenged.
Yes, in some senses. In some senses, yes. In some senses, no. Let me begin actually with how it's not. My own views of faith haven't been changed at all. And I've actually probably in the last several years met and been around people whose own faith has deepened mine, and the relationships that have been created has made me, I think, a wiser person from the Christian perspective. What has been shaken was my understanding and views toward the evangelical world. I have always been an evangelical ever since I came to faith, but I wrote a piece actually in the New York Times at the end of last year where I said I no longer called myself either a Republican or an evangelical.
That's where I was heading.
Yeah, I made clear I'm still a conservative,
right.
And I made clear that I'm still a Christian. The reason that I'm been alienated from the evangelical world to some large extent is because I think that it has done tremendous damage to the Christian witness. I think that a lot of self-proclaimed evangelicals in their conduct, particularly during the Trump era, have defaced Christianity and harmed it. Now, I want to be careful. The evangelical movement is a huge movement. It's about a fifth or 15% of the population. I know a lot of evangelicals, good friends of mine. Some people are conflicted on Trump. But as a movement, and in terms of the faces and voices of the evangelical movement today, whether you're talking about Franklin Graham or Eric Metaxas or Robert Jeffress or Jerry Falwell Jr., you can go down the list. I think that the way that those people have conducted themselves publicly has done tremendous damage to the Christian.
Well, let's try to work through this, because and you and I have talked about this before, and I mentioned before we started the podcast that when it comes to the question of what has happened to the Christians in this political era, I've gone through the process of I don't get it, I don't understand it, to figuring out, okay, now I think I understand it, I think I can explain it, and then I can't. So let's just go back to this. I mean, first of all, this is a shock. I mean, I think if you go back, if somebody would have told you back in 2014 that this would have occurred, that the evangelical Christians would be the one demographic group that would be, you know, think that personal character was the least important for someone's ability to serve in public office, we would not have believed it. We wouldn't have believed the number of mulligans that would have been handed out. So you've thought and you've written a lot about this. How do you explain the Jerry Falwell Juniors? I mean, some of it may be just the personal character of the individuals, but in general, when you see the polls, the number of evangelical Christians, white evangelical Christians, who are right down the line with Donald Trump, knowing or presumably knowing, you know, everything about his character and his approach and the values that he's representing.
Yeah, look, I think there's been a huge amount of hypocrisy and double standards. As I understand it, what explains this phenomenon, it's complicated. But I think one of the elements that's important to understand is that a lot of white evangelicals are being driven by fear, which eventually gives way to anger. And it's a fear that the country is changing. Excuse me. It's a fear that the country's changing, that they're losing influence, that they're under attack. And there's a lot of resentment that has built up among Christians over the years and over the decades. Some of it is warranted. There's no question that there is an elite culture that has looked down at people of the Christian faith who are conservative. But I found during the rise of Donald Trump, and I was a very early critic of Donald Trump because I thought that he embodied so many qualities that I found pernicious. And I really did believe and said at the time that I thought he would fundamentally change the Republican Party and conservative movement.
That aged well.
Yeah, unfortunately it did. But I heard from a lot of friends who are evangelical Christians who disagreed with me. And the thing that some version of this kept coming up again and again and again, and it was Donald Trump is a fighter. John McCain, George W. Bush, even Ronald Reagan, admirable people, too genteel. Mitt Romney, they lost Romney and McCain. And what we need is a fighter. We need somebody who's going to go to a knife fight with a Glock. Mm-hmm. There was an interview that Tony Perkins did about a year or two ago, and during that interview, he said something that got a lot of attention, which is, we're going to give Donald Trump a mulligan. Mm-hmm.
But there this was after the payoff to the porn star, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. And he was pressed about this mm-hmm. idea, which for years evangelical Christians said what mattered was character in a president. That was the argument that was made, as you well know mm-hmm. and remember, during the Clinton years. And now all of a sudden you have a man who is so manifestly corrupt and the evangelical world is so supportive of him. And he said, well, we're going to give him a mulligan because he's pursuing policies that we like. But then he said something else that didn't get as much attention, but I thought actually was a deeper insight into what explains the evangelical attachment. And that is that he said that Trump is a guy on the playground who's going to punch the bully in the nose. And the bully, from Tony Perkins' perspective, and the bully from a lot of perspectives of white evangelical Christians, are the liberals, are the elite media, are the Democrats. And so when they saw Donald Trump's style, the cruelty of it, the dehumanization, the idea that if I'm attacked, I'm going to hit back mm-hmm. 10 times harder, I think, unfortunately, for a lot of white evangelical Christians, that had a cathartic effect. They saw it
That is how it is described in the Gospel of Matthew, right? I'm a little shaky on the details.
No, Matthew 5, Beatitude, Sermon on the Mount, and you will see that basically Donald Trump is the embodiment of Jesus in
the
21st
century. So you have all of that. He is our champion. He is our Cyrus who has risen up, right, you know, to redeem the people. But it lost in all of that is kind of the essence of Christianity, which is the, you know, universal caring for others, a sense of fundamental decency, which is understating it sort of in the Victorian term. But it is a kind of compassion that seems to have gotten lost in all of this Christianity as simply truculence.
That's right, and that's why it's so discouraging what's happened, and it's a real cautionary tale of the dangers of politics for people of the Christian faith. I think what's happened is that what has been revealed is that faith is subordinate to partisanship and ideology. That's not how it's supposed to work. It's if you're a person of faith, that should be the starting point, and you imperfectly try and mold the rest of your life to your faith commitments as best you can. In this case, I think what happened is that people approach this from a partisan perspective, and they have decided to shape and reshape and disfigure Christianity to fit their predilections.
You know, Russell Moore has made this point, you know, that yes, we need to fight for religious liberty, but the point of religious liberty, you know, is of course to be able to advance, you know, the fundamental principles of the gospel. If you lose the fundamental principles, then really, what is the point? Is all of this an indication, perhaps, that a lot of, and just I'm just as a theory, the thinness of the Christianity on the ground, because the way you put it, that obviously faith should come before political partisanship, the fact that it has been reversed, what does that say about the state of Christianity? And we've been talking about evangelical Christians, but clearly there are issues involving the Catholic Church and other denominations as well. What does it say about the state of Christianity right now that so many Christians would look at this and go, yeah, we want the guy that's going to punch somebody in the nose on the playground?
I think it shows that the state of Christianity in America is thin and that it's shallow and that the faith commitments aren't nearly as strong as they ought to be, and that people's commitments to the deepest truths of Christianity aren't what we thought. I don't think that politics is the only manifestation of that, but I think it's one of the manifestations of it. Look, there are just not as many transformed lives as there should be, and I'm a person who struggles with this too. I'm sure my life is not nearly as transformed as it should be, or even that I would hope that it would be. So the pilgrimage is difficult, but what the Trump era has shown in such stark relief is exactly the point that you made, which is the idea that people of the Christian faith would so enthusiastically support a person who is engaged in so much dehumanization, so much cruelty, so much lying. He's engaged not just in an attack on truth, but an effort to annihilate truth. I understand the argument, and I know you do too, of those who in 2016 said there's a binary choice between Clinton and Trump, and it's a hard choice, but we're going to choose Trump. But we're going to choose Trump because he's going to advance principles and policies that we care about.
And judges. And abortion.
Yeah, judges and abortion and a whole series of issues. And so they decided, with reservation, to support him. That I understand. I disagreed with it. I didn't vote for Trump. But it's a respectable position. What I don't understand and what I don't think is justifiable is the enthusiastic support that we've seen for Trump. It's no longer a binary choice between Clinton and Trump. And it is so clear what Trump is. And he has a Nietzschean ethic, not a Christian ethic.
And you wrote this back in 2016. And I quoted you just recently about all of this, that it is a Nietzschean. It is the will to power, that we evaluate somebody by their strength. It is the ethic of the Superman, which is very clearly diametrically opposed to the Christian method. And yet, as you point out, it's not just that he's better than Hillary Clinton. He is being enthusiastically embraced.
That is exactly right. Donald Trump is the antithesis of a Christian ethic, and he seems to delight in it. And so many of his supporters seem to enjoy watching this play out. And that has a huge cost, because the rest of the world watches this and they say, this is a joke. Yeah. This is a charade.
So what does this mean for evangelical Christians? Leaving aside the political, I would think that the concern would be that for a generation or more, that this would cast, you know, a stain on evangelical Christianity, and might in fact, and you know, I'm very right to life. I'm very, very pro-life. That this will discredit many of those movements by being associated with Trumpism. I mean, are there cracks within the evangelical movement, people saying, look, what you're doing is you are undermining this movement long-term for these short-term partisan advantages?
Yeah, that is exactly what's going on. And I must say that's part of the reason that I and friends of mine like Mike Gerson, who's an evangelical Christian, have written so much about this, because we feel like it's extremely important to say that this is not a monolithic block, that not every evangelical Christian or person of the Christian faith buys into Donald Trump and the way he practices politics and what he embodies. I do think this is going to be discrediting. I think it's going to do a lot of damage to the Christian church and to the Christian witness for the reasons we've been talking about, which is people will see this and they'll say, look, this is double standards. This is hypocrisy. If it's a liberal Democrat, you say you care about morality and character and leaders. You care about truth and all of the rest. And when it's Donald Trump, we don't care about it. I'll tell you one thing that is happening, which I think is probably going to have a good effect. The younger generation of Christians and evangelical Christians, I think, are really moving away from mm-hmm. the old guard. There is a huge, huge gap between people who are, say, 55 and above of the Christian faith and Donald Trump, and people who are 30 and below. And I actually think that watching the squalid show play out is convincing a lot of younger Christians that this is not the way to do it, and that they want a different kind of ethic, a different kind of political involvement. My concern is that they become cynical out of the whole process and give up in politics, which I think would be terrible, because politics, for all of its drawbacks, matters, because it's finally and fundamentally about justice, and justice always matters. But my hope is that younger generation of Christians is going to learn from the mistakes of the older generation and find a better way to engage in politics and society and culture.
Let's talk about the White House. You've worked in the White House. You've watched the White House for many years. The Trump White House, I think, I was going to say, is coming more into focus, although I think we've had a pretty good idea. There's a new book coming out, was it Nest of Vipers or Den of Vipers, which really confirms a lot of the contemporaneous reporting that has been going on. What really strikes me about these accounts is not only how chaotic the mind of the president is, but really the mediocrity of the administration that he's put together. And Chris Christie is writing about the riffraff that he put together. Of course, he has his own scores to settle. But that all of the accounts seem to be consistent, that we're not dealing with a White House that is engaging in four-dimensional chess or great strategic planning. And you were the head of the Office of Strategic Planning. There's not a lot of strategic planning, that you have a guy wandering around to the White House watching television, drinking Diet Coke, and, you know, calling up Paul Ryan and saying that you're like a dog.
Yeah, it is amazing to watch, particularly if you did work in a White House, because in my experience, and experience of almost everybody that I know, Democrat or Republican, in past White Houses, there's such a premium put on process, on making sure that you minimize chaos to the degree you can, because you find out that there's so much in life, in the world, in the White House that you can't control, that what you have to do is make sure that the things you can control, you do.
And things can go badly wrong.
And things can go badly wrong. And if the process breaks down, that can lead to chaos or disaster. Now, so far, that hasn't happened. But I'm very worried that this is going to catch up with the country and catch up with Trump and his administration. It is an utterly chaotic administration. If you talk to people in the White House, or if you talk to Republican members of Congress who have dealt with Trump and dealt with the White House, they will tell you, in fact, I would say, in my experience, based on what I've heard, things are worse than we think based on the media reports. It is extraordinary. And so this is not a functioning White House. And if we have a crisis and you don't have a functioning White House, and on top of that, you have a president who himself is emotionally and psychologically unstable and volatile. I think Donald Trump has a personality disorder, and I've said that for a long time now. I think that has the makings of a potential disaster. That, by the way, is I opposed Donald Trump for all sorts of reasons when he was running. But one of the reasons, among the chief reasons that I did, is that in my experience, what's most important in a president is temperament, is disposition, is character in the broad sense. I'm a person that spent my entire life in public policy. It matters a lot. It matters where you check the boxes.
But there's so much that happens when you're in the White House that you can't anticipate. And that, in the end, requires a president to have a certain kind of temperament and disposition. You know, when I was in the Bush White House, we thought that the Bush presidency would be defined by domestic matters. Mm-hmm. And then September 11th happened. And of course, the course of the administration completely changed. In Donald Trump, it's not only that he is temperamentally unfit to be president, he's in a category we've never seen before.
Well, you wrote this back in last March, that character is fate. That's as true for a president as it is for anyone else. And so it is no surprise the Trump presidency is engulfed in chaos. So what would you recommend if you, and this may have actually happened, if you had someone who came to you and said, all right, I have a chance to go work for this administration, you know, the arguments pro and con, either being complicit or maybe you could be the guy who, you know, is able to stand in the breach and prevent something awful. What do you recommend people who wonder whether or not they should go into this administration right now? Into this White House?
Yeah, I've actually had those conversations with people. And the answer is it depends on facts and circumstances. What I've told people is if they feel like in good conscience they can go in and do good and restrain the worst of Trump's impulses, I don't see a principled or moral reason not to go in. On the other hand, if you're in a position in the White House, let's say the press secretary or a close aide, and you are going out day after day defending the lies of Donald Trump, then I think you become complicit in the lies and the corruption. And I don't think that there's any easy answer to it or any book you can pull off the shelf and say, you know, that this position means you could go in and this position you wouldn't. I was glad that Jim Mattis and H.R. McMaster mm-hmm. were in the administration. But I would say that an awful lot of people in the Trump White House have ended up corrupting themselves because they have gone out and actively perpetrated the lies and the deceit that Donald Trump puts forward. And if that happens, if you find your own personal integrity being destroyed, then I think you have to leave, and so I think an awful lot of people in the administration, in the White House, and frankly in Congress, have come out worse for having been in the Trump orbit.
Well, this is something that Jonathan Last, who works with us here at the Bulwark, had written some years ago: that Trumpism corrupts, and you've seen that not just in the administration, but this whole thing we've been the process we've been talking about. You know, what people are willing to accept, the way in which the Republican Party and the conservative movement has transformed itself on so many issues. One of the things that I think we've learned about the presidency that came as a shock, and I want to give credit to Garry Kasparov for this, is that, you know, that many of the norms that we had assumed would constrain the presidency really were pretty much an honor system, and based on the assumption that there will always be honorable men and women who would sit in the Oval Office. And now we are finding out what happens if, in fact, the honor system confronts someone like a Donald Trump. We realize that our system is much more fragile than we might have suspected.
Yeah, that's right. It turns out that a lot of life, including political life, is based not just on legal stricture, but on these unwritten rules and customs and habits and a sense of this is what you do and this is what you don't do. There's a line from the early 19th century, obedience to the unenforceable. That is, the things that you can't enforce by law, but you have to be obedient to make a society and a civilization work. And what Donald Trump has done is he's come in and he has disrupted all of that. And he's basically decided that he is going to, you know, blast through norms and lines of civility and decency like a drunk, you know, will run through barriers on a road. And we don't quite know what to do with that. And we're, as a society and as a country, trying to work through what that means. And I think what's going to happen is several things. One is there's going to be a real cost to it because we're going to find out that it's difficult to live a fulfilled life or to flourish as a country if those norms are shattered.
And I think that will be the echoes of that will be felt for a very, very long time.
I think that's right. Let me tell you what my hope is. My hope is that viruses create antibodies, and that sometimes there are virtues in the life of an individual or the life of a nation that you take for granted. But when they're stripped from you, when they're lost, when they're shattered, then you begin to see why they mattered after all. And then there, you see the human cost of having lost those things. And it may well be that people say, we have to reclaim them again. And that's what I hope happens, that there's a kind of great awakening, if you will, in terms of democratic virtues, and that people will fight back against this and build from the ashes that that Donald Trump is going to leave.
Peter Wiener, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me on.
And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.